Good evening and welcome to the Icecast. My name is Shane Chebsey. On the Icecast, we talk to writers, artists and publishers in the comics world about their work, about their careers and everything in between. And tonight on the Icecast, I am honoured to welcome Mr. Steve McManus. Good evening, Steve. How are you?
Good evening, Shane. I'm well, thank you.
Good. Glad to hear it. I just caught you sneakily drinking a glass of wine there. I'm very envious.
Well, I have to keep my reputation up.
Say no more. We've never met before properly, have we? We were just saying offline, and it's a miracle, really, you know, because I mean, you've been in the comics sort of world a lot longer than me, but we've both sort of been in the same circles. We've got a lot of friends in common, but somehow our paths have just never crossed, have they?
I know, it's bizarre. I remember Deborah Tate sort of was a connection in terms of attending many of your conventions with Robbie, of course.
And, yes.
That's as close, I think, as I got to you.
One degree of separation.
Yeah.
And of course, Deb worked with you on, was it Sonic the Comic?
Yeah, she edited Sonic the Comic and was responsible for bringing Mike McMahon back into public view.
With
all credit to her for that.
Yeah, definitely.
She's a good one.
She is. And Robbie too, he's a good friend. As you say, he's been a lot of my conventions, and he lives very close to me now here in Shrewsbury. They both do, so it's...
You're part of the Shrewsbury Mafia.
I am, yes, part of the Shrewsbury Mafia, yeah. Yeah, it's a growing organisation. One day we will achieve world domination.
Of course, there's the Dark Lord up on the hill, you know, isn't there?
Well, you're referring to Mr. Wagner there?
I am. Only joking, John.
I'm sure he would not take offence.
No, of course not.
So, I'd like to talk initially, Steve, about your early career, because... I mean, everyone knows that you were Tharg between 1979 and 1986, and that was an amazing period of 2000 AD, and we will go on to that. But before 2000 AD, you started with IPC, was it around 1973, something like that, working on Valiant, was it?
That's correct, yes, exactly, 1973. I would have been 20 years old.
Wow.
September 1973, straight in on Valiant. Lucky.
Yeah.
Where my editor was Stuart Wales, and his boss was Sid Bicknell, and Sid's boss was Jack LeGrand. So, nice. Yes, it was.
A good experience for you. Did you hit the ground running? I mean, obviously, with it being your first sort of editorial post, was it a steep learning curve?
Very much so. Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing. But to be fair, Stuart, you know, gave me a chance. He told me how to open a package of artwork, and therein would be the script and the art, and then compare what the artist had done with the writer's scene descriptions. Mm. And when you were happy with that, pass it to a letterer who would barge in through the door in a hurry, amidst a cloud of cigarette smoke. Everyone smoked in those days.
Indeed, yeah. You often see on dramas depicting the 70s, you know, a lot of people smoking. And to us now, it seems like did they really smoke that much? I think, you know, but it really was like that, wasn't it? All the offices everywhere were full of smoke and the ceilings were all yellow.
Well, it was highly dangerous, I thought, because every office had an open tin of cow gum, which is an inflammable glue.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Health and safety didn't happen, did it? There was no health and safety, basically, back in the 70s.
You're quite correct. I started on Valiant September 1973. And they weren't too sure of me at first.
Right.
Sid said back to me later after he said, well, now we are sure of you. So credit to them for giving me that little bit of, you know, induction leeway.
Mm.
Otherwise, who knows?
Indeed. And what was your sort of inspiration for going into comics editorial? Was it something you always wanted to do, or was it just a job that you fell into through other interests?
Well, the comic I ended up on was Valiant, which I used to read as a child anyway. So that was a happy coincidence.
All but right.
To be fair, Fleetway also, among comics, they also published football magazines, and it was a football magazine I was aiming for.
You're a football fan then?
I was, yes. And yeah. I thought, you know, I could write some good words about the sport, but it never crossed my mind that I would end up, that I would be on a comic. That was in my youth. I wasn't a fan particularly, although I appreciated the art.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, it's kind of by accident that I ended up
Okay, it's funny. I talk to a lot of people, sort of from your generation, you know, who give me a similar answer. Say it was not actually their intention to write comics. Oh. It was something that they fell into through a desire to maybe be a journalist or maybe to be a strip or maybe a comic strip artist, which is a bit different to a comic artist. You know, slightly different ambitions, and then the work comes along, and it's sort of like, well, I'll do it. I'm a professional. I'll turn my hand to this. And then 30 years later, they're still doing it. You know?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Maybe in those days, it was a less kind of structured, you must be, I am heading to be a this or a that. More of a, ooh, I'm not quite sure. And let's see how the cookie crumbles.
Yeah, definitely. I think now people need to be more focused on what they want to do. I don't think there's much scope for experimentation with your career like it was back then. I could be wrong because I don't remember it because I'm a little bit younger than you. But I, even in my time, you know, I remember when I started, you know, in the world of work in the sort of late 80s, it was very different then to how it is now. I feel for youngsters sort of getting into, you know, just leaving education, unless you know exactly what you want to do and you're kitted out to do it, it's a real struggle, I would say.
I agree.
But then, obviously, after a couple of years at Valiant, you moved on to, I think it was Battle, wasn't it? Was that working, who was that working with, Steve?
David Hunt, who'd been an editor at Fleetway for some time, again, on the football side more.
Yeah.
But he found himself given the job of getting this new title to press under the direction of two creatives named Pat Mills and John Wagner.
Yes.
So the idea was he would blend his editorial skills with their creative skills, and each week a comic would emerge at the end of it.
And it did, invariably.
It did.
Some great comics as well.
Yeah. I mean, there were moments, I think, when Dave tore his hair out, and eventually it came to pass that Pat and John said, okay, we'll step back now, otherwise you'll never get the comic out. We had 12 issues under our belt, and we knew there was a hit there. So Pat and John stepped back, and Dave looked across the desk at me and said, right, Skeely boy, time to get some scripts out.
Yeah.
And that was how we progressed.
And the deadlines then were very tight, weren't they? I mean, was it a weekly book that was coming out, a weekly comic that was coming out?
Well, it was, and it was very, in that sense, there was no stockpiling at all. You weren't allowed to commission a guy, you know, to spend a year doing some stuff, and then you pull it out of the drawer.
Mm.
Much as I enjoyed Valiant, I really found my feet on Battle, because I am actually quite a fan of the Second World War.
Right.
So I really sort of enjoyed the reality of Battle compared to Valiant's Captain Hurricane.
Yeah,
superhero.
Yeah.
And there were some great stories in Battle.
They're very good character stories, some of them, weren't they? And like you say, more based on the historical side of, you know, the Second World War.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
particularly one of my favourites is kind of like anything to do with the Russian front.
Right.
Because I read a lot of Sven Hassel, and I think most of his team were on the Russian front. And Jerry Finley Day seemed to like the basic stories there as well.
Mm.
For example, Panzer G-Man, Hellman and stuff. So it was kind of combining a childhood of pleasure of reading comics with an adult kind of professional view of getting the same back to the next generation.
And war comics back then were still very fashionable, weren't they? There was a few war titles out with other publishers, and and Battle, I think, was probably one of the leading titles. But at the time, there was around that time, Warlord was kicking about, wasn't it, with the with another company?
yes, good old Dundee-based DC Thompson's.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So they got Warlord out first, which was then IPC Fleetway had to respond.
Yeah.
So Battle came out, but don't forget, all the time there were all these war picture libraries.
Yeah, the little books. Yeah.
And they were just selling it to everyone, from kids to people who'd been in the war.
Yeah.
So yes, you're quite right. The and then with the 70s, which we may get onto in a minute, slightly more realistic approach, and then it kind of like in on the TV and cinema, The Longest Day, and all these films came out that kind of reignited an interest.
Yeah, there's a whole new generation, I think, because like you say, there was a lot of people who remembered the war still around then, who were reading and consuming all of that. But there was a whole new generation, wasn't there, who sort of maybe remembered it, well, didn't remember it, and romanticized it, perhaps. And
they had uncles and grandparents who'd been in it.
Yeah, and told them all the stories.
So yeah. they kind of that kind of interest, good or bad, got passed down.
Definitely. I mean, I had a huge interest in World War II from my great-grandfather when he was alive. He told me some stories, and there's a few grandparents actually who told me stories, you know, and it fascinated me, World War II.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of, were they in the Navy or the Air Force? Or?
Well, I had one relative who was a prisoner of war in Germany for a long period of time. He got shot down. He was a great grandfather, my mum's granddad, and he had incredible stories, you know, that my mum passed on to me as well, because he was gone before I really understood what he was saying, you know, but my mum kept those stories and passed them on to me. And I think, you know, when stories are passed on through the generations, they become almost mythic, don't they, within the family,
yes,
you know.
Of course.
And the imagery that was passed on, those stories. I mean, they weren't pleasant stories by any means, you know.
No. But
they still inspire, because the fact that he survived and he came back and, you know, had a family and all that, you know, that's powerful stuff. And when it's in your own family, you know, and I think that sort of powerful imagery and those powerful family stories, it meant that war stories in general, I think, at that period in time, that new generation, they were inspired by their own relatives. So the reading about these stories that their relatives had told them, it's powerful stuff.
Yeah, it's. I think the guy telling it wasn't telling it as an, oh, look at me, I'm a hero.
No.
But the person hearing it, the younger person, was thinking, oh, yeah, I want to go out and be, you know, cowboys and Indians without fully understanding.
Yeah, no understanding really of the... Yeah.
Really?
No, yeah. Not at all.
What it was like to be in a prison camp for 4 years. Oh,
no.
They would have said, all right, tonight we're going to pretend we're escaping. So then when a comic came out about the war, I'm by that.
Yeah, just latch onto it. But of course, then a new generation, late 70s, we had, I think, a big thing was Star Wars, wasn't it? And science fiction and science fantasy suddenly, you know, in the mid 70s became, you know, a huge thing that sort of, and war stories were sort of pushed to the side a little bit. Cowboys and Indians, as you mentioned before, was another big genre that was popular in the 60s and the early 70s. But then 2018 emerged in 77, pretty much alongside Star Wars, and it sort of changed the landscape of British comics a little bit, would you say?
Well, there was a sequence, I think, from Battle to Action to 2000 AD, each of which were the birth child of Pat Mills with inspired input from John Wagner and Jerry Fina Day. But
we can't forget Action, can we? I mean, it was a short-lived title, but, oh gosh, people still talk about it today with such reverence.
Yeah.
I mean, so I do remember Action, and I loved it. It was incredibly violent. But when you're a young kid, that's just cool. and it's something, I think the idea of it was that it was forbidden. It was kids love things that they can't have, don't they? And action was something they really shouldn't have, and that is why they wanted it. So, and you were involved, weren't you, with Action, and then also Star-Lord, which became 2000 AD. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, when I was working on Battle, Pat Mills was putting Action together, and he needed writers. And the way it worked with me was he would feed me the idea, and I would go away and turn it into a script, and then take it back, and he would cut a bit, and, you know, and then we'd have a script to go to an artist. But then one day he came up to me and he said, as I recall, I might be wrong, we're looking for someone to do some dangerous stunts, you know, like being dropped into the North Sea.
Oh, was this your stint as Action Man?
Well, exactly, yeah.
It does sound very dangerous, some of the things that you did.
I know. My dad wasn't, being a doctor, was a hypochondriac anyway. He didn't like the idea of me. He was very upset, but...
I bet. I mean, I was looking into some of the things, some of the stunts, and they sounded like very dangerous, very risky. I mean, did you actually do all these things? Were they real or not?
Yeah, I did them all. Wow. The only two I couldn't do was driving the London bus on the skid patch because I couldn't drive. Riding some 1,000cc motorbike, which the editor... Kelvin wasn't the editor of Action, he was on 2000, but he took over that.
Yeah.
And he also, actually, he also skidded the bus as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was good at cars. Kelvin, you know, he was into planes, cars and trains.
Right, that was his thing, like.
Yeah, big time.
I'm surprised we didn't see more sort of vehicle-led stories in the comics.
Well, I think the second issue of Star-Lord Roadbusters, a plane crashes into a skyscraper, and they have to sort of, so that would have been Kelvin's idea, I think.
I actually missed out on Star-Lord. I was obviously, you know, a little bit too young, and I missed the boat on that one. But I do hear like really revered tales about it, you know, even though it was a very short-lived title. What was the story behind that? How did that sort of, obviously it was a very short-lived title. What happened and why was it such a short-lived title?
Well, I think Kelvin, having sort of worked with Pat on 2000 AD, felt he could go a little bit higher and maybe produce a magazine that had more in common with what was coming out of Europe, heavy metal, and a Spanish thing called Simoc, which is comic backwards. And he wanted to do something like that with some more features. So perhaps also inspired by a magazine called Omni, from the guy who did Penthouse.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of science fiction going on here. and the first issue was really on good paper. Mm. It had a voice. It had Strontium Dog and Roadbusters and Mind Wars. It was a good call. I'm not entirely sure why it was merged into 2000 AD rather than the other way around, but that's what happened. And so I got transferred from Star-Lord to the 2000 AD.
And then obviously, and this is sort of, we're talking around 1979, aren't we?
76, so that would be 78, halfway through, yeah.
And was this around the time that you were writing stuff like Mark One and the Tornado, was it?
Yeah, Pat, when he launched 2000 with Kelvin, Mark One needed several writers, so I became one of the stable. Even though I worked as a staff member, it was great. It was freelance. So not only did you get paid by the company, you got a check in the post as well. I mean,
double whammy. Great.
It was a double whammy. My bank book was just incredible. I could have bought a house with it.
Fantastic.
But Pat would just ring up or he'd come and see me in Battle and say, right, I want you to write about, this was Mac One, why don't we do The Balls of the Gods? And I'd say, what the hell do you mean, The Balls of the Gods? And he'd say, well, we need to go to South America where all these Incas and stuff were having these civilizations and see if you can make a story out of that.
Right.
And Tornado Kelvin, again, needed writers, and he had this great script called Lawless.
Yeah.
Some kind of guy. And I did write one of those, which was quite fun.
And it's different, isn't it, being an editor to being a writer? So did you have aspirations to be a writer when you sort of started working in comics? Or was it just something that just happened when you formed the relationship with Pat and John and people like that?
Yeah, it just happened, I think. If any aspiration I'd had was to be a playwright.
Right.
And not that much difference, because basically it's two... as dialogue and a scene description, walks on stage. but leave the rest of the producer stroke actor artist.
Yeah.
It was just a crazy time when someone would say, can you write this? And you'd say, yeah. You weren't consciously thinking, oh, this is the first start of my mega plan to be the next Tom Tully or Scott Goodall or whomever. And pretty soon it dried up anyway. So I found that it was best I just stuck to being a kind of editorial honcho.
Was there a sort of expectation when 2000 AD began that it would be this long-running title that would still be around today? Or did they feel that it was just going to be another one of those titles that would run for a few years and then be replaced by something else?
It was halfway in between, I think, in the sense that the first issue was, as you said earlier, quite markedly different from the first issue of previous comics, even. Because it was so... the pictures were bigger, the heroes were more interesting.
Yeah.
As you say, the war had kind of become dull and stuff. And the future looked really a good place to sort of want to pay your pocket money.
Yeah.
So when I read the first issue in 2000, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
But more like a firework going off in... you know, someone chucking a banger at you. You don't know if there's going to be anything coming out of that. it was just, wow, yeah, okay, now I'm going to have a drink. So half and half.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean... I do remember the first 2000 AD. I do remember that. And I remember being absolutely blown away by it. You know, as a youngster who I'd not long learned to read, you know, it was one of the first things that I, you know, picked up along with all the Marvel reprints and all that. Because when you're young, you don't have any sort of, there's no barriers to anything, is there? You're just willing to read everything when you're really young. You just want to consume. Well, I did anyway. So I was reading like Marvel reprints as well as 2000 AD, as well as The Beano, and pretty much anything that I could get my hands on, basically. But 2000 AD to me seemed like another level. It really did. It was so in your face. And the world that it created, especially Judge Dredd, I remember just thinking, this is a really tough, grim world. Some of the things that they would say, some of the things that the characters would say, you know, would be that little bit more risky, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
And that was obviously John's voice and Pat's voice coming through on those stories. I mean, what was it like working with those guys at that time? It seemed, I could be wrong, but tell me if I'm wrong, but it seemed as though they were just full of ideas and full of energy.
Yeah, they're different people. Pat is kind of a massive extrovert.
Yeah.
And John is very much the not the introvert, but the silent sort of. and you can see that in their stories. Pat goes for his big pictures. He doesn't want you to leave a page without having had something smack you in the face.
Yes.
John, as it sort of slowly built on Dredd, likes to tell a story and trusts the reader to follow along. But coming back to your earlier thing about 2000 AD, I guess my real reaction was, this is so good. How can they keep this up? And how can they keep this level of thrill power as it came to be known?
Yeah.
We can all do a great first issue. I mean, you can spend a year and, you know, great. But in a week's time, you need the next issue.
Yeah.
And I think it took some time for 2000 to find a level where it could deliver each week.
Yeah.
Not quite the same amount for par, but a level.
Yeah, it was very consistent, wasn't it? I mean, I remember sort of when you took over, actually, in the late 70s, early 80s, that was probably its most consistent time, I think. There just seemed to be this constant, and you brought in new creators as well, didn't you? Like new blood, as it were, sort of like later on, people like Graham Morrison and it sort of livened things up a little bit and brought in a whole new set of readers. I mean, did you find that the readership was on it steadily going up at that time?
Yeah, it was growing up if the title was two, the readers had become 2 years older. The title was five, then an 8-year-old was now 13. So it was a natural, organic. And then, as you say, the new writers kind of like just coming from having read it perhaps as a bit younger, bringing their more adult, their kind of take on it in their script. So it was just everyone wanted to work for 2000 AD. You didn't have to go looking.
No.
It was just, oh my God, everyone, artists. And it was, I always felt that we couldn't really read every single submission.
No, I was just going to say, it must have been really hard to keep up with all of that. I mean, I assume that you just had this level, this bar, and you just had to sort of prioritize what stuff you looked at and what stuff you considered. And the bar was pretty high at that time.
It's easier with an artist, I think, to judge where they are, and where they can go, and how you can help them. With a writer, maybe it's not quite so easy. So you have to spend more time, which is quite time consuming when you've got to get 32 pages out every week.
Yeah.
And there's only, oh God.
So yeah, so new creators, and there were other names as well. People like Peter Milligan, Dave Gibbons as well, was a mainstay at 2000 AD, wasn't he? And obviously Alan Moore as well, did some early stories over at 2000 AD. Do you remember getting those submissions in from any of those guys? Or any submissions that stay with you that you remember that you thought, wow, this guy is just yes straight away?
Well, Alan Moore's easy because at the time my sub-editor was Alan Grant.
Ah, right.
And I said to Alan Grant, do you mind going through the unsolicited submissions?
Yeah.
Which he did with a fine tooth comb. And it was him who came across a submission from Alan Moore.
Right.
And Alan Grant then wrote to Alan Moore, have a long letter saying this is, where I think you should be heading. And the rest is history.
Yeah.
So well done, Alan Grant. Obviously, Dave Gibbons had been with 2000 from issue one, so I wasn't...
Yeah,
My first view of him was seeing his art in the comic on Fallen Heroes. Grant Morrison, we knew of at the time we worked in Fogg's spaceship. We were on the 20th floor, but it was very hard to gain access to the 20th floor, let alone any floor.
Yeah.
But Grant Morrison somehow managed to magic himself up to...
Well, he is a magician, isn't he? So.
Yeah. No, it's true. And he just kind of casually walked in and got a few future shots for you. And the rest again is history. We just, I think in my book, The Mighty One, My Life Inside the Nerve Center, I remark that you wait ages for a writer and then three come along at once. And in this case, the three were Grant Morrison, John Smith, and Peter Milligan.
Wow. That's a pretty good hall of writers, isn't it?
Yeah. I knew Pete through Brendan McCarthy and Brett Ewins, RIP, Gary Leach. They were kind of like a set.
Yeah.
So that's more or less how it happened, yeah.
Mm. And so, I mean, obviously that we talked about the golden age, as many people call it, of 2000 AD, which was your stint from 79 to 86. But then after that, you took on a more, I would say, probably quite a challenging role, which was to expand the titles. And you had a huge hand in bringing out stuff like Crisis, which I remember very fondly, which again brought in some of the old guard, but also some interesting new creators as well. mean, I remember Carlos Esquerra having the Third World War story, but there was also some other really interesting stuff going on. How did that happen? How did crisis germinate?
Well, as you say, the idea that one could build on the success of 2000 AD in the way, in fact, later on we did with Judge Dredd the magazine. We
just
expanded his world. But coming back, build on the success of this picture strip title that probably could needed to stretch its wings a bit with a different type of story that maybe we could flog to the Americans.
Actually. Right. Was that the thought behind it, was it, to go into that American market?
The very first brief was create two superheroes that we can repackage for the American market.
Ah, interesting.
So that's why Crisis has one kind of superhero story, New Statesman.
Yes.
But halfway through the development of the other story, Pat said, look, I think I've got this Third World War story that isn't superhero, but may well strike a chord with an older audience.
Yeah.
So, but after that, then people who couldn't get into 2000 AD because it was so busy, it began to find work on Crisis through one-offs or sort of a wider remit. Sean Phillips, Duncan Figredo, so many great artists and writers sort of started their first baby step on Crisis, and you know they remember it to this day, and they. If I see them at a convention, they slow to say thank you.
Yeah. I mean, and rightly so, you know. I mean, what you did with that was really exciting, bringing in all that yet another wave of incredible talent. These people are still huge names in comic industry today. Sean and Duncan just create amazing work. And that whole wave did, in fact, go to America and did some amazing work. I mean, Peter Milligan did some great stuff with Sean Phillips, actually, and Duncan, with Vertigo and publishers like that, and very fondly remembered stuff. And it was a very sort of adult-themed wave, wasn't it? A lot of those creators, they didn't really seem to have any interest in doing stuff for kids or even for teenagers. It was more sort of for the adult market. Was that where your interest lay at that time, or were you just reading what was going to be popular?
Well, I think we'd seen Dark Knight by Frank Miller and Watchmen by Dave and Alan, so you could see there was a market for another level of storytelling beyond, in America certainly, they were stuck with. And again, harking back to the European market, all those that great stuff there, Bande Dessinée. I think we all felt that there had to be a voice, a place where British people could have a say. And my insurance policy, of course, was 2000 AD. That was making the money. And so it would have been hard to sack me because I was having a sort of fling with this kind of strange title called Crisis. But in the end, it kind of died, but its brief life to give life to many people who perhaps would never have had a career.
Definitely. And I was astonished when it did fade out, because for me, it never stopped being exciting. Yeah, I think I got every issue, and it was just always really, really exciting. And when it ended, I just thought, well, why? Why on earth has this ended? This is one of the best comics on the market, you know. And there was a lot of other cool stuff as well. It was quite, I guess it got quite competitive in that adult market for comics. And there was a lot of people who had the same idea, not just this side of the pond, but on the other side of the pond as well. So I suppose, you know, you were competing for a big market at the time, but still a limited market, I guess. But, and then obviously, the magazine came out a little bit after Crisis, didn't it? And that's still with us today.
Well, there you go.
Yes. And, I mean, I guess the idea behind the magazine was to expand, you know, the Judge Dredd universe. There were some great creators again there. But there was also some of the old guard coming back on the magazine. Was it the intention to sort of mix and match in that way, to have some of the old creators who'd worked on early 2000 AD, but also some of the new creators that were sort of emerging?
Yeah, because it works like, well, then the idea was Crysis was like launching a really fast car, not quite sure. So we wanted to be a little bit more steady with Dread, and we felt it was that car would be safest in the hands of people who'd already drawn him.
Yeah.
So Cam Kennedy, Jim Bakey, Carlos, and then obviously Colin McNeil. These were steady, safe pair of hands. All we wanted was people who could bring to life John's great scripts, John and Alan's scripts. Mm-hmm. If we could get that right, it was a slam dunk. There was no need to experiment with what we all knew was a popular comic strip anyway. So that's why, as you say, it was kind of handed back a little bit to the old guard. Well, not the old guard, but we pulled our horns in a bit, kind of thing.
But it makes sense. And but also at the same time, it was different to 2000 AD. There were some longer form stories in there, weren't there? And the writers were able to sort of, you know, do something with a little bit more depth, perhaps, than what they would have done in the 2000 AD format.
Of course, because, it was a monthly as opposed to a weekly. So the stories had to be longer and were meant to be longer, as you say, to kind of progress from short, sharp, beginning, middle, end shock to a more contiguous, is that word? A more sort of novel. And we're sort of approaching the term graphic novel here, where this is all meant to be bound up anyway into a book that you can then resell, which was very much in the air.
Yeah,
that whole notion. And I think we had the advantage over, say, Penguin, who might have to commission that book, but we'd already paid for it, and it had paid for itself. All we had to do was bind it up and sell it again. And you can see today that America, that is now, has been selling ever since as a bound volume.
Yeah, I think the book market is a really strong market. And, you know, even as comics then declined, sort of, in, you know, obviously there was this boom in the 90s, and the 90s boom happened in the UK as well. And then obviously there was this huge decline in the late 90s. Did that affect 2000 AD and the magazine in the same way that it affected the American comics, do you think?
Well, by this time we'd been taken over by a Danish company, Egmont.
Yes, yeah.
And their business plan was to get a license to a character, stick a bit of plastic on the cover, and then not so much have comic strip inside as puzzles and stuff.
Yeah.
Spot the difference and pin-ups. And so when they bought us, they kind of found they had this 2000 AD stable and they weren't sure what to do with it. And it all kind of spiraled into a kind of loss of sales, loss of confidence, and the American exodus movement of job people.
A lot of the talent went as well, didn't it? Oh, that's the thing. Yeah. I mean, because that's around the time that John and Alan started doing stuff for DC, and Pat was doing stuff for lots of publishers, and it just like you say, this mass exodus of talent. So what do you do in that situation? You know, when all your talent is working elsewhere, and the editorial got their hands tied in a way.
Yeah,
it must have been a difficult time.
I think it was. The two sort of hot titles then actually were Barbie and Sonic the Comic.
Right.
These were the real big sellers.
Yeah.
And they were making huge amounts of money, whereas 2000 and the magazine had kind of fallen. They'd never been appreciated anyway by Egmont, perhaps. So
no.
They were just looking for someone to come along and buy them.
I remember Sonic being hugely popular. I never read it myself. I was a little bit old at that point to be reading that. But when I talk to people who are about 10 years younger than me, their memory of Sonic the Comic is, you know, they loved it. And there were some great creators as well on that book. I remember some of the artists and writers, you know, there's some talent. But obviously it's a totally different market, isn't it?
Well, Richard Burton, who was a big video game fan, was handed it to be the editor. And he found that, as you say, there were people, artists and writers, who loved that and were happy to take their passion and put it on the page. I think Nigel Kitchen is a name, but as someone who, but many people like him, In fact, they even knew more than Sega, who owned the damn character, because there would be meetings where the Sega people would be put to shame because they didn't know that Dr. Robotnik was spelt backwards, was this or that, or some Kinterbar, you know, whichever way you do it. So it was, to answer your question, it was a tough time because our company seemed to be focusing on a much younger audience. And also, I mean, there were plenty of people, I think, who wanted to draw for 2000, but there was no room for them to practice.
No.
So they might have been thrown in the deep end and their art, you know, it wasn't fair to them. Their art looked a bit wonky until they got a few pages and seen their art in print, for God's sakes.
I mean, it's scary the first time, you know, you see your art in print when you're learning your craft. You suddenly see every single error. It's horrible. Yeah. I think every comic artist probably goes through that in their early career, don't they? I would wonder how many, if you asked every comic artist and said, how did you feel the first time you saw your work in print? Because obviously the standard answer is always, you know, oh, it felt great, I was honored to be in that book, you know. And, but the reality is probably they just went, oh my God, it's awful.
I know, horrid. Whereas as a writer, you can probably just say, oh, well, you know, the sub-editor killed all my dialogue or something.
You can blame someone else, It's hard to blame someone else when you're an artist. You could always, if you're an art team, you could always blame maybe the inker or the colorist or something like that. But of course, it's very different, isn't it? It's different with British comics, though, again, because most, I mean, they do it all themselves, don't they? At least the inking and the penciling. You don't get the sort of penciler and the inker and then the colorist sort of conveyor belt with the British
comics. No, well, not the guy I ever knew.
No. And I like that. I like the fact that it's just one guy doing it or one girl doing it, you know.
I remember Mike Collins used to pencil and Mark Farmer would ink him.
Yes.
But that was the only combination I recall working in that American way.
But Mike wrote as well, didn't he? So Mike would write a story and pencil it out and then Mark would come and do the finished art. So I suppose it sort of makes sense because that's quite a lot of work, isn't it, if you're writing and penciling.
Yeah, exactly. I see you have a bookshelf behind you.
I do. It's probably not as respectable as yours, but...
I saw your interview with Dan Cornwell.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And he kept reaching behind him to his bookshelf for stuff to show you.
It was great. He'd have this like point of conversation. He goes, well, I got this book and to show you. And he had everything on his bookshelf behind him. It was great. It was a great source of conversation.
I only heard the audio of that, but I wanted you to see that at least I do too have a bookcase. Not as amazing as yours or Dan's, but... it's mainly Beatle books, actually.
It's a very neat, well-organized bookshelf.
Yeah, it's cool. All my CDs.
Yeah.
So I think I come second in the Chesapeake Cornwall McManus bookshelf of the year.
I think I'll have to start a feature on the podcast, you know, like check out the bookshelf of the person I'm interviewing, see what they've got.
I'll show you yours if you show me mine.
Mine's pretty low bar, to be honest. There's a couple of good. There's a Watchman.
Oh, nice, yeah.
And I've got the old, if you can see those, the Zenith books.
Oh, nice, nice.
Yeah. They're quite hard to find, actually, these.
Are they? Yeah.
Yeah, they're not, they're pretty... Because they've been re-released now, but I mean that's another story I loved from 2000 AD. Zenith, you know, Grant Morrison, Steve Yeul, and I think I can't remember who I was talking to about it. It might have been on another podcast, but Steve Yeul's approach to that book really inspired me as an artist. You know, his sort of black and whites and the really sort of heavy black shadows and the way that he constructed the pages. It was almost a little bit of a revelation. I thought, oh, I really like that. I want to work like that. You know, and for a while, I was a bit of a Steve Yeul clone. You know, you wear your influences on your sleeve. No, definitely not. But you do wear your influences on your sleeve, don't you? Early on in your creativity.
Sure, and why not? That was standard advice. Find an artist you like and sort of copy their style, and eventually, chrysalis-like, you will emerge. Your own style will you take out of that.
Definitely.
But I remember, Steve drew a future shock for us, and it was very interesting looking at his artwork. And then when Grant Morrison said, "Well, I want Steve to draw Zenith," it was, I thought, well, that makes sense to me. So it's funny how life can be that easy sometimes. I want him, you got him.
Right place, right time. It's just time, it's nice when that happens, isn't it? It's really nice.
It is really nice because it gives one sort of stamina to soldier on in the expectation that there will be a few of those in the future rather than a landscape of Zimmer frames and nurse ratchets, you know.
What other sort of partnerships do you remember being really sort of fruitful at 2000 AD?
Well, to be fair, I think looking back, what I did was just get the comic to press on time. So that's more of a production issue. But those people who were able to come into the office who lived locally in London, we got to know each other very well. So Tom Frame, the letterer, Steve Dillon, we more or less spend our evenings in the pub discovering, and then I'd have to shout at Steve because he hadn't done his dread, or Tom had lost it in some burger bar in Kentstown.
I did hear the story about Steve, you know, drawing his pages in the pub.
But that happy days, it's kind of a little bit like rock and roll. There were too many fab. It was mainly men. Could have done with more sort of.
It was. It very much was a boys' club, wasn't it? 2000.
All the comics at Fleet. I know Ginty and Tammy. Ginty had Mavis Miller was the editor, but Tammy, Jerry was the editor, I think. So it's a shame there were some very good artists and writers, but they seem to get lost in the. This tidal wave of macho 70s hard-bitten heroes. There wasn't much room.
I mean, it was a different time, wasn't it? You know, it was a different time.
Oh, yeah.
But did you... So, I mean, you mentioned there that there were some good writers and artists. So were there female artists sort of trying to get into 2000 AD, but did they not get the opportunities, or were there barriers for them?
Gosh, there wouldn't have been barriers because all you wanted was
good artists. Yeah.
Would take even a bad script and make it work. But I don't recall that many, no. This was the time, I mean, there weren't many avenues anyway because all the girls' comics died out and photo strips had come in. It wasn't. It'd be interesting to hear from someone of that era what they did instead.
I mean, obviously things have changed now, and I wouldn't say it's 50-50, but there's definitely a lot more female artists around and writers, and it's great to see those different voices coming through, not just in British comics, but in American comics as well. I guess the thing is, the genre in itself, it's very boyish, wasn't it? I mean, it was a boys' comic. It was quite violent. The subject matter lent itself to a male audience, and therefore, I guess, female creators didn't feel it was for them, perhaps.
Exactly what you just said, yeah. And there were a lot of agents, anyway, at the time, who were representing the artists. So Dave Gibbons and Brown were represented by Bard and Art. Mike McMahon was represented by Temple. Carlos was represented by Bard and Art. Creaciones Editora Arles represented Ian Gibson. And I don't remember any of those agents coming up saying, "I've got this great, not female, but artist who actually is a woman," kind of thing.
I mean, so I guess that could have been one of the barriers, was the agencies perhaps weren't
Yeah. Sort of, well, there you have it, you see.
Yeah.
It
could well have been. Because you forget that. I forget that. And I think a lot of fans forget that, is that, you know, back then agencies were a big thing, weren't they? I mean, now mostly publishers deal directly with the creators. But then pretty much everyone had an agent.
Yes, even Ron Smith, Temple Art. Mm. In a small way, Colin Wilson's agent was Brian Bolland, in the sense that Brian brought him into the office and said, look, Steve, is this really good artist? And then stepped back. But,
And did that happen quite a lot? Did you get artists and writers bringing people in themselves, you know, recommending people that they'd met at shows or that they or had written to them, perhaps, and sort of took them under their wing?
I think Brian Talbot did quite a bit of that.
Yeah.
I think he recommended to Pat Glenn Fabry.
All right. Good call.
Or Pat recommended, you know. But yeah, I think Brian was always open to people visiting him and showing him their work and him encouraging them. Mm. So yeah, that's one instance I remember.
Mm. That's nice. I mean, you don't always get that, you know, in other sort of publishing areas, and especially not in comics, you know. Yes, you do get people who will encourage, but to actively sort of push people to the editorial, you know, that doesn't always happen. I think now, especially because there's so little work, I think people see new people, not everybody, because I've met lots of great, generous creators who've given their time and their expertise. But I think there are a lot of creators now who feel that they don't want the new creators coming forward because there's only so much work, and well, they want the work, you know?
Yes. It's like London taxi drivers. They call the new boys butter boys because they say they take the bread out of them.
That's it. Yeah, definitely. I think there is a sense of that in the industry.
It's a shame because...
It is a shame.
Well, it's just a shame. There should be enough work for everyone, but obviously not.
Not at the moment, anyway. So sort of after 2008 AD, you left sort of editing comics for a little while, but then you wrote. We've mentioned it already, but I wanted to mention it again. Mm. You wrote your memoirs, The Mighty One, My Life Inside the Nerve Center. what a great title! What was your sort of inspiration for that? What made you decide that you wanted to do that?
Well, that's quite an easy answer.
Someone offered you a lot of money.
Yeah, after six pints of red wine. So I hadn't really been in touch with the comic industry as I knew it. I'd been out of the loop. But when I eventually sort of came across on Facebook these groups dedicated to 2000 and this and that and the other, and I had some time, I thought, well, I've got a story some of these people might like to hear, because they're always banging on about, oh, I read issue one of Action or Valley or this. So before I knew it, after 3 years, I had 80,000 words written. I just happened to mention it on Twitter, I think, and within 5 minutes, Ben Smith at Rebellion was on the. Got in touch saying we'd like to publish this.
Fantastic!
So that was one of those examples where someone says yes. You know,
it happened
just like that. There was no need to pitch him to do rewrites, to worry. It was just like a done deal.
Yeah, that's great. And it's done well, hasn't it? It's done really well. I mean, people are always talking about it and on the forums and on the Facebook groups. I haven't got a copy myself, I will admit, but it is on my to-buy list, and I will be getting a copy.
I can send you a signed copy for £12.
Oh, that's very good. That's a bargain. I'll take you up on that one, definitely. Thank you. Yes, hey, it's good to support. It's good to support writers. I do try and do my bit, you know. And obviously, you've now got involved with one of those groups, haven't you? I was chatting with Ben Cullis last night, and he was saying that you've done a story for the 77. Is that right?
That is so. That is, yeah. It's great. It's thrilling because I feel like I'm back in.
It's like you've gone full circle. Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah,
except I'm seeing it from the other end. I'm kind of like a writer, and I've got this publisher editor saying, "Well, I'm seeing what it's like to." Oh God, okay, yeah. And Ben and his team on 77. You know, it's amazing about this kind of notion of a love letter to the comics that I started work on in the 70s. Yeah. And I had a story in the first issue and a story in the second issue. I think the issue 3 is out November, I think.
Yes, I think it's out next week, I think.
Or
maybe even the end of this week. I'm not sure. It's not long now.
Because what happened was Ben said to me, well, you know, this novel you wrote, which is a kind of basically the mighty one but told in fiction, so no one sues me. at the end of it, I wrote 5 scripts, and he said, why don't we put those out as the comic, but it's meant to be in the book.
Yeah.
So that's what we're looking forward to next year. So, yeah, it's all back to... It's like the first issue of Battle or Action or 2000 come out.
Fantastic. It's almost like, regaining that sort of, that initial sort of, as you said, the firework goes bang. It's going bang again. I'm really looking forward to seeing that because there's some great artists involved in the 77 as well. And you can tell there's so much love goes into that book.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it really is. And the community around it, these are dedicated fans, you know, who love 2000 AD and especially that period of 2000 AD when you were helming the comic, you know, that I think it's like universally loved. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. So, because I think in your Ice with Dan Cornwall, he mentioned he might be drawing something for the 77.
Yes, he did.
Which I think is actually going to be one of the scripts I wrote.
Fantastic.
But I don't know. I hope he doesn't go cold on the idea.
Oh, I'm sure he won't. He seemed very keen when I spoke to him. So I think he will definitely be carrying on with that.
Good. Well, yes. Well, so, yeah, everyone send down a card saying, do not give up on this trip.
No, I think it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a great book. I'm sure of it. So I'm aware that I've kept you for over the hour now, Steve.
Oh, good. Thank you. No, I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you and to sort of go down memory lane and talk about all those great comics that you're involved with and to speak to you, you know, and to get to know you a little bit because, as I said before, we had not properly met. So it's been a real pleasure to properly meet you, even though it is on a screen. Hopefully we can meet in person at some point.
Oh God, yeah. No, next year, all that stuff permitting. Yeah. We shall, without doubt, Shane.
Definitely.
Thank you very much for asking me to appear on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for appearing and have a great evening.
You too. Okay.
Bye-bye.